For the week of November 8th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 301, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
So what's it feel like, Michael, to have more than 300 episodes? Because last week was our 300th episode, and this week we have more than 300 episodes. So we're one past 300.
I guess I'm virtually excited.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. I know. You're trying to get us right into what we're going to talk about this week, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I guess on this week's show, we are going to be getting real, or at least virtually real, as Michael just said, because we're going to be delving into the hype behind virtual reality and augmented reality and try to make some sense out of what all the fuss is about. Even the New York Times is trying to get in on the trend by launching their own VR initiative. Sort of. We'll explain what they did. Speaking of trends, China. That's it, just China. They're a trend unto themselves. It seems a week doesn't go by in which Hollywood isn't trying to find some new way to break into the large Asian market, but a couple of international groups are claiming China isn't abiding to the trade rules it agreed to way back when. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about the worldwide box office. We get our information from RentTrack. You'll find a link in our show notes. We also pull info from The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, Variety, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, and everyone agrees. The number one movie around the world is Bond. James Bond, and of course, it's Spectre. It grossed $190 million over the weekend. It's at $300 million worldwide, and it needs every penny because it costs so much to make.
Yeah, I actually ran into somebody who was one of the financial people on it and was like, oh, it's cost so much money. And they actually got it down to, I think, $245. I think they
Does that count the money that they make on product endorsements? Because there was a lot of talk on the last movie about a lot of money coming in from product endorsements. And there's plenty of products that are displayed in this movie as well.
Well, that would be considered, you know, income, but their budget was $245-ish.
So that's not like tax breaks where you didn't actually spend the money. Because I hate when they say, well, it was $300 million, but after tax breaks, it was only $110. It's like, well, then you spent $110. But in this case, you're saying the budget was they spent $250 million roughly. And then, of course, they did get some income like Heineken and the cars that are shown and Tom Ford suits and all that sort of stuff.
Right. All the things that they could probably pay for, they got for free and then got
paid. Oh, well, they wouldn't pay for them.
Yeah. Now, the 250 figure, okay, 245, 250, probably.
It goes up every minute that you look. Someone says, this is 350, 400 to make and market, 500. You know, they just keep raising the bar every time they mention it.
It's like the U.S.'s international debt. Yeah, it's but in this case, those budgetary figures almost always include the money, the soft money, as they say, that like Mexico gives them for shooting in Mexico City. I understand your point, Michael, where you're saying, okay, but how much money did you outlay? Because that's what you got to make back.
Right. And we don't have access to that info, so we don't know. But I saw the movie. I thought it was fine. It's
really?
A Bond film. I don't know why it got such bad reviews.
I don't know either. I've seen some of it, not all of it. I'm waiting to go see it in Dolby Cinema over in Burbank. I have to.
It's a lair. There's a Bond girl. There's action. Bond is tied up at one point with a supervillain right near him. You know, what did you expect? At number two is a movie we didn't expect probably to be such a success. It's the Peanuts movie. It made $50 million opening up in a few territories, most of it here in North America, where it was a big, big success story. Here in the U.S., it made $45 million, which is about as much as all the previous Peanuts films combined overall. And that is including even almost adjusting for inflation. Because the first Peanuts movie way back in like 1969 made $6 million. And that's about $40 million in today's dollars. But the rest of them were kind of flops. They really didn't make much money at all. One of them made like $250,000. That's Snoopy Come Home, which is actually maybe the best one. So this movie, out of the gate, will clearly be making more than all the other Peanut movies combined.
Well, it opened in China, the Peanuts movie, and it literally made peanuts.
Yes, there it did poorly. And we'll talk more about China's box office in a few minutes because it is kind of interesting. And people said, will this one work? Kids don't know the Peanuts. They have no idea who these key characters are. But it's not true. While the strip stopped making originals, reruns are in every paper in the country practically. And the specials air on TV every year. It's not part of the DNA of kids, maybe the way SpongeBob SquarePants is, but Peanuts certainly has not disappeared. And clearly, the movie got good reviews. People liked it. It's a great success story. There will be more.
Well, you know who kids really didn't know about 4 years ago? And they still went to see them anyway?
What?
Minions. They still went. They had no idea who they were. They were brand new. And yet, the film still did fine. So you don't necessarily always need to have an inbuilt audience or a built-in audience.
Sometimes you make original things.
Right. Sometimes, you just open at the right time and your release pattern is perfect that you're attracting families with children because there's nothing else out for them.
Or in this case, happily, it's something that got good reviews as an actually good movie. And that may be one reason why Spectre opened a little soft here in the U.S. It's the second biggest Bond opening of all time. But the last movie, Skyfall, made a ton of money and it had the biggest Bond opening of all time. No, this didn't do as well. Well, that movie opened unopposed. There were no other movies in the marketplace. And this weekend, Peanuts movie was a big success. So while there's not a lot of crossover between 8-year-old kids and Bond films, there's some. You got parents, you got teenagers, little older kids. Maybe you take a 12-year-old to Peanuts. Maybe you take them to Bond.
Well, yeah. And they're saying that this will probably drop by 50% next weekend here in North America. So that they'll make...
Well, that's typical.
Yeah, it's typical. And that there might be some crossover that they'll get 2 weeks in a row where they have... they go see Peanuts this weekend and next weekend they go see Spectre. You know, the adults get to go see Spectre. But it did.
There's nothing opening up next week either. It's 2 weekends away where we get the Mockingjay, the final Hunger Games movie.
You know, it's funny because I actually can't remember what happened in the last Mockingjay movie. I'm going to have to rewatch it.
But can you remember what happened in The Maze Runner 2?
No, because I never saw it. But before we get off of Spectre, you know, it may not have broken records here, but it broke records, of course, we mentioned last week in the UK. In Mexico, Brazil, Russia, Belgium, Austria, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Poland, and more.
It's big, big world. That's why we don't just talk about the North American box office, because that would be wildly misleading.
No, and I know why you're talking about The Maze Runner 2, because I would imagine it's number 3 at the box office.
That's right. It made $22 million over the weekend. Thank you, China, where it opened up. It's made $300 million worldwide and counting. And number 4 is The Martian, Ridley Scott's film. I just watched The Good Wife. He produces that TV show. And he's got The Martian in theaters. It is about to become his biggest hit of all time. Not adjusted for inflation, but it may get there before all is said and done. It made $16 million over... I beg your pardon. It made $18 million over the weekend. It's going to pass the $500 million mark. At number 5 is Hotel Transylvania 2. Adam Sandler is happy. That made another $18 million. It's at $400 million worldwide and counting. And number 6 is a Chinese film. It's actually a Chinese-Hong Kong co-production. It's a romantic comedy called The X-Files 2, which is not about The X-Files, the sci-fi, but X-Files, meaning your ex-boyfriend or girlfriend. This is the sequel. It made $17 million over the weekend. And it raises the question for me. I kind of really only thought there was an artistic difference between, saying, China and Hong Kong, especially since China took over Hong Kong again, but it still has a semi-independent status?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Well, not much of one, but I guess so you can have a co-production between China and Hong Kong.
That's right. Yeah. On an economic level, it is separate as well. So,
All right. Well, number 7 is The Last Witch Hunter. That's the Vin Diesel movie, right?
Yes.
Another $13 million. It's at $85 million worldwide. And number 8 is Everest. That is the... is it Matt Damon too?
No.
It's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes.
So similar. That made $13 million over the weekend. That's about to pass $200 million worldwide. And then we have a South Korean film. This is The Priests. It's a sort of a crime horror flick. Two priests have found a little girl, and they have to decide whether she's just been molested by an evil man or possessed by a demon. And they have to figure out the answer to that in order to save her soul. That's the premise. I don't think they're going to remake that one anytime soon, but it made $11 million on its opening weekend. And number 10 is Goosebumps, another $10 million. That's about to pass $100 million worldwide. Steven Spielberg is doing fine with Bridge of Spies. That's chugging along here in North America and opening up in some other territories around the world. That's at $72 million worldwide. Paranormal Activity has fallen hard. $67 million worldwide, though, so it's chugging along. And again, given that it's the fifth film in the franchise, it's doing just fine, or at least what you would expect. And there's Burnt, also collapsing. And then there's Last Woman Standing, another Chinese film. This is a romance starring Shu Qi of Hao Shaoshen's The Assassin. She's been in a number of his movies. And it opened up to just over $6 million in three territories.
I would imagine China being one of them.
Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Then The Intern. The Intern we talked about a little bit last week. That made another $4 million. It's at $180 million worldwide. I am sexist. I talked about the director, Nancy Myers, maybe getting a piece of the back end. I talked about Robert De Niro, one of the stars, getting a piece of the back end. But I didn't mention Anne Hathaway. She is the star of the movie, right?
Yes, and now Academy Award-winning star of the movie. They're both Academy Award-winning stars.
Yes, and I didn't mention her for the back end. Am I sexist, or am I just acknowledging the reality of Hollywood?
I think you were actually trying to be polite by not talking about Anne Hathaway's back end.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for now raising it down to the level of their physical appearance. Way to go, Sperling.
That was
so anyway,
the whole
I think
joke.
In fact that I don't think of women getting back ends a lot, unless you're talking about Sandra Bullock or maybe Julie Roberts back in the day. It doesn't happen very much. And so Anne Hathaway, it didn't occur to me, as it often doesn't occur to male Hollywood executives. And when the women don't fight and ask for it, they don't get it. Thank you, Jennifer Lawrence.
Yes.
And at number 16 is The Witness. This is the Chinese film. It's a remake of a South Korean film called Blind. It made $4 million over the weekend. It's at $30 million and counting. That's the box. Oh, well, there's a couple things to talk about. The Dressmaker is in Australia, and perhaps maybe New Zealand is the other territory. This is sort of a comeback film for director Jocelyn Moorhouse. She did a great little movie called Proof with a young Russell Crowe. I really like that movie a lot. And then she had some ill-fated Hollywood movies. Her husband had good success with Muriel's Wedding and some other stuff that she produced, but she hadn't directed a film for almost 20 years. And now she's back, got very good reviews in this Kate Winslet film, which Moorhouse describes as kind of like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven with a sewing machine. It's a black revenge comedy. It's doing great in Australia. We'll have to see if it makes it here to the U.S. I'm sure it will.
Well, will it do any business in China? Because that's really where everybody's eyes are pointed these days.
That's right. I feel like China is holding its own, you know. There are five movies opened up in China this week. Three are Hollywood films. Two are Chinese films or Chinese Hong Kong co-productions. And, you know, they all went mano a mano, and China did great and Hollywood did great. The biggest new opener in China, where is that baby? I lost my notes. Oh, there it is. The Maze Runner made $20 million in China. But then right below it is X-Files, that movie I talked about. That made $17 million in four territories. I think it's probably the number two film in China. At number three is Everest. That made $11 million. And then at number four is another Chinese film, The Last Woman Standing. That made $6 million. And then the Peanuts movie really did not do well. I guess they just don't show Peanuts comic strips in Chinese newspapers. But you can see how you got a Hollywood movie, then a Chinese movie. The order could have been, you know, flipped up a little bit, but they're all holding each own. Hollywood movies are popular. Chinese films are, you know, doing just as well. So it's a very, very healthy market.
Well, and notice how they kind of pitted a... two Fox films against one another. You had Peanuts, which is a Fox film, against Maze Runner, a Fox film.
Ah, so they said they want you to cannibalize your own.
Yeah, pretty much.
And of course, we know that come December, there will be no American films in the box office because it's all about China. It's a blackout period where they want their movies to dominate for the holiday period.
Right, and of course, that's completely fair and exactly what they had agreed to. Wait, no, actually, no, that's not what they agreed to when they joined the World Trade Organization.
That's right. Every once in a while, somebody speaks up and says, China's not obeying the agreement it made. China and Hollywood just confirmed, hey, they've got an agreement. They've got this long-term deal we've been talking about for many years. There's all these rules in place, and China's not yet taking action on what they promised. For example, China agreed in 2012 that they would license private companies to distribute movies in China, provide some competition for the one authorized government agency. We talked about it when it happened back in 2012. They still haven't done so.
Well, but they're going to get to it eventually at some point in the future, be it distant or near, because they have to, and so they will comply moving forward in the future at some point.
That's right. And is there's really no justification for the quotas they have in place, not under the World Trade Organization. They still haven't taken the state-owned entities out of that equation. So you still have to deal with government agencies in order to get your movies into the theaters. And the Independent Film and Television Alliance is not happy about it. It's a significant trade group, right? They sort of represent a lot of people beyond the MPAA members, right?
Correct.
And they say they're not doing their job. And one of their top people says, right now we have limited implementation and limited efforts to adopt regulations along with the growth of the market. They're trying to set, you know, a little fire to the feet of China. And they said, what makes us seethe is that we spent 7 years negotiating this agreement to settle the WTO complaints, which still leaves the Chinese government with a lot of control. And yet China is not acknowledging that this agreement exists. It's not like we're dealing with a developing country. They have a solid economy, solid production companies, and outlets that can only benefit from increased trade.
And who said this? This is the IFTA, correct?
This is one of the spokespersons for the IFTA. That's correct.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, the IFTA, think about it. They're the ones representing, you know, the producers of Diary of a Teenage Girl or
they're not getting anywhere near the Chinese market.
No, because basically you have the big Hollywood studios. What China wants is big spectacle movies that kind of translate into the Chinese market that can be put into the IMAX theaters that have been built. They're building 15 screens per day in China. So mm-hmm. many, in fact, that what is it this year? $6.4 billion, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they're projected to make. The North American market makes $10.4 billion, $11 billion in a good year. So they are projected that
$11 billion in a record-breaking year.
Yes. Okay, fine. I said a good year. But really, right now, China is projected to supplant North America as the top movie market box office wise in 2017. It used to be 2018. It used to be 2020. So it keeps moving up. It'll be interesting to see as this industry gets more visibility in China and in the world, just how much control they can maintain over it.
And there's a natural tension here, isn't there? Because the people who make movies in China, Chinese films, they want to dominate the box office. They want to get all the credit. They want to keep Hollywood away from them during the big holiday periods. But the theater owners, they want to get the big Hollywood movies, right? They want to show Star Wars. And they want to show that Star Wars is going to make a lot of money in China. They want to show they're an important market for the world. They're going to be number one in just a blink of an eye. So there is that tension there, isn't there, between wanting to let your homegrown movies do really well and being able to attract the big Hollywood movies and show them off and make a lot of money for yourself and everybody around.
Yeah, well, the one person I do not envy in all of this is Chris Dodd over at the MPAA. I mean, he was successful in getting the quota raised to 34 titles per year. I guess it was up from 20. And now, I mean, they're making it official, actually, by saying that the Chinese will kind of monitor the box office a little better, and they will, what is the other thing they're doing?
Auditing. They're going to allow some auditing.
Yeah, they're going to allow some auditing. Those are two things that the studio
eventually.
Eventually, yeah. Someday in the future, you know, down the line, yeah.
And there must be some Chinese executive, some Chinese official who is the equivalent to Chris Dowd, not as such, but someone who has to negotiate and deal with both the theater owners and the movie makers. That can't be a lot of fun either.
Yeah, well, over at SARFT, which is the Chinese equivalent. Well, I don't know if it's the Chinese equivalent of the MPAA, but it's one of the big
cheeses. Well, tell them to give us a call.
Yeah, well,
and
yeah.
If they do, how will they reach us? If they want to be on the show, if you're in a top official at SARFT?
Yes.
All right. How does he get in touch with you, Sperling?
Wow, actually, a mid-show plug for our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or our voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Not sure whether it's toll-free from China, but it is for most of the world. You can also follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or reach out on Facebook, where our page can be found. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox.
That's right. And they're building a lot of theaters, of course, and so is Arclight here in North America. I'd never heard of them, but they have a cinema opening in Chicago, and they're mostly, I guess, in California. Sperling, do you ever go there?
You know, when I lived in Hollywood, I went there all the time because that was the first theater to open, the first Arclight theater to open. And it was like brand new and shiny, and they had no commercials. You couldn't arrive late. They had this thing called reserved seating, which nobody had at the time. The problem was they were really expensive. Their tickets were like noticeably more than other theaters.
Like $3 more, $2 more, like $4
more? $2 to $3 more. Now, that said, on Sunday, Sunday matinees were more expensive than Sunday evenings. So they did the reverse. They needed more people to come Sunday evening to the theaters than Sunday matinees because Sunday
more demand.
Right. So they reversed that. But
no, they didn't. They priced it higher for when there's the more demand.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I think
that's
we're
not
agreeing.
Reverse. That's the way it's normally done. That's why you have, you know, cheaper Tuesdays because people don't go to the movies on Tuesdays. But I've never heard of them. They have no commercials, no late arrivals. They have a limited number of trailers, no ads, which is great. They have no box office, just kiosks apparently or online. But there's a fee to belong.
Oh yeah, okay. So they were the first group, one of the first groups to do this whole membership where you pay to be a part of their membership, their loyalty program.
Oh, it's not that you can't go buy a ticket.
You can buy a ticket, but you know, if you want like after 100 points, you get a free popcorn.
Oh, and they make you pay for that. Wow.
Yeah, that was actually the last time. Like the second they said that I had to pay, I was like, yeah, no.
And they have a liquor license, right? They've got a bar, they've got a little better food choices.
They were one of the first to kind of do the whole restaurant and bar in Los Angeles. I know that Alamo Drafthouse was doing,
yeah,
but they were kind of like, hey, you know what? Let's toy with this whole premium experience by adding a full serve restaurant, full serve bar, and cafe. It was very, very nice. And that was in Hollywood. Then they opened one in Sherman Oaks, same concept. They have a bunch of them now, one in Pasadena. Now they're moving to Chicago. They're kind of seen as upscale, but not as upscale as, say, Cinepolis, which, you know, you're paying $25 a movie ticket at times.
Wow, I don't know them at all.
Yeah, you're basically watching a movie with, like, you know, on a couch. And
none of them have come to New York yet.
None of them have come to New York, no.
That's right. Well, if when they do come to New York, they'll probably be showing some art house films, right? What are the big European films right now?
I would imagine, based on the European Film Awards, it's got to be The Lobster. Right?
That's right.
I mean, because what? And Yorgos Lanthimos, right? That's how you pronounce his name. He it's a kind of a sci-fi film. It's quirky. He directed Dogtooth before that. The Lobster, it premiered in Cannes. I liked it. I enjoyed it in Cannes. I guess
it's one of the big winners for the European Film Award nominations.
That's right. Along with Sebastian Schlipper's Victoria. It's a one-shot movie. Paolo Sorrentino's Youth, also a Cannes premiere. Some other titles included on the, I don't want to say shortlist for the Oscar, but they've been put up for Best Foreign Language Film. Roy Anderson's Swedish dramedy, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence. Now, wasn't
terrific
that,
movie.
Wasn't that in Berlin as well?
I don't know where it played because I haven't been at the festival circuit lately.
An Icelandic film, Rams, and a French drama, Mustang.
So those are all movies that have been nominated for European Film Awards.
Yes. And then screenplay was Ex Machina, 45 Years.
Yeah,
the Pigeon movie. And The Lobster, Youth. So, yeah, the European Film Awards, I don't know when they're being held. I probably should have looked that up. But when you look at both the European Film Awards and the British Independent Film Awards, you see the same films being mentioned.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Including, by the way, Asif Kapadia's Amy documentary on Amy Winehouse.
Uh-huh. And Lobster, of course, co-stars Ben Whishaw.
Yes. And
who is in the new Bond film.
Okay. I didn't know what
as
the...
Q.
Okay. I did not know that.
That's right. He's on top of the world. He's getting nominations in multiple European awards, and he's in the number one film in the world.
For this week.
For this week, and probably last week, and probably and perhaps next week, because there's no big movie until 2 weeks from now. So, in fact...
Do you think he's getting credit for that, or could it possibly be Daniel Craig?
I think it's Q.
Okay.
I think Q is the big deal for this Bond movie.
I see what you're doing. You're trying to move us onto Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, first CBS announced it would be launching a new Star Trek TV show exclusively on its over-the-top service, CBS All Access. Now, Showtime has announced that the new Twin Peaks miniseries, which is already filming in 2015, won't come out until 2017. Is co-creator David Lynch planning to fuss over the editing? No, it's just that Showtime thinks Twin Peaks will be just the sort of property to bring people to buy into Showtime's OTT offering. Why this means making fans wait when 2016 would be the 25th anniversary of the original show's debut isn't really clear. In fact, one might even question whether the show's original fans would even know what OTT is. But anyway, the 18 episodes will air someday, somewhere, and you may watch it on cable or an app or on VOD or in a room with a little person who talks backwards. And when it does, it'll be in good company. The new Star Trek series will debut in January of 2017. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think the big deal here is that the over-the-top services are powering how they schedule these big new shows.
Yes, that is absolutely true. This is a big deal.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That they're saying, we've got the biggest property we've got, and we're going to use that to power our apps, power our OTT service. That's where they see the future. It's just like the studios where they hold back, you know, Blu-ray and DVD and release digital copies of their movies weeks in advance because they want you to buy a digital copy.
Well, in the case of the Hollywood studios, they call that early electronic sell-through. And what they're really doing is saying, look, you know what, movie theaters? We're not breaking that 90-day window, okay? We're just kind of breaking it a little bit. 2 weeks early, we're going to let digital downloaders, which, come on, it's such a small group of people.
I don't believe those are breaking the 90-day window.
I think they are most of the time.
Huh.
It's their backdoor way of breaking that window.
But they really want sales to be via digital anyway. They don't want to send you a disc. They don't want to send you a thing. You might even, in fact, buy it directly from them. So it's a big advantage for them in every possible way.
Right. Well, it also proves that Showtime, HBO, CBS, they're no longer scared of their affiliates and the MSOs, the big cable operators. Before, they would never do this because the cable operators would come down really hard on them.
Well, what they're scared about is missing out on the new business.
Right. And so what they're really saying is, you know what? Let's start going direct. You know, let's take it straight to the consumer. And we make more money that way, possibly anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of going directly to the consumer and these kind of over-the-top plays, it's said that you can't go home again. But that's true unless you're Jon Stewart, in which case you can go wherever the hell you want. For the retired Daily Show host, that means growing a beard and returning to HBO. Stewart signed a 4-year deal with the channel, /app/brand. It's a multi-hyphenate now. He'll be creating timely short-form digital content specifically for the app HBO Now, as well as HBO Go, but not the actual HBO. A lot of HBO in that last sentence. At least he won't be creating anything for HBO yet. In other words, bite-sized videos that will pop up throughout the day if you subscribe to cable and use HBO Go, or if you purchase their app. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it sounds like it's starting out like a big whoop. Is someone going to buy HBO Now because there might be a 2-minute video by Jon Stewart? I feel like he's just keeping busy, like he's bored or something. it seems like a strange little thing to sprinkle over HBO Now, but I guess every little bit helps. The real play, I assume, is if he gets more engaged and creates a show or a series or whatever, new content, that they want to be in business with Jon Stewart.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this initial foray here is like, hey, you know what? Don't get out of practice. Just, you know, here's something creative to do and it'll, you know, it'll be on Apple TVs and the Rokus of the world. And meanwhile,
well, I don't know. Will it?
Yes, absolutely. HBO Go.
Oh, HBO Now will be. Yes. Oh, I thought you meant. Yeah.
And meanwhile, while you're doing all that, you know, since it's not going to take up all of your time, how about you give us a few TV series ideas? How about that?
Meanwhile, Mars, like, I'm still here. I still do my show real time.
Yeah.
Stay out of my wheelhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Harry Potter. You're the best, Hunger Games. It's blockbuster titles like those two that deserve some of the credit for good news in the publishing industry. According to a new survey by Pew, people aged 18 to 29 are more likely to have read a book in the last year than older people. This particular survey has only been around since 2011, but its numbers show 72% of all adults read at least one book in the past year, while 80% of young people said the same thing. Sadly, 27% of all adults said they didn't read a single book in the past year, which means dating John Waters is out of the question for them. Women read more books, about 14 in a year, while men average 9 books. Big deal or big whoop?
Men are stupid. I guess it's J.K. Rowling, right? You know, Thank you, J.K. Rowling, for doing this, helping to spark reading for young people. She's writing another kid's book, she says. Meanwhile, that play that she's got in London, we mentioned it last week or the week before, they have sold $30 million worth of tickets. They put an entire year on sale. They keep selling out like 3 month, 4 month spans. I have friends who are seeing it 8, 9 months after the show opens. They're going to be seeing the replacement cast. I mean, this is just crazily successful. So be fascinated to see where it ends up. But it's always good to see young people reading.
Well, my daughters are almost all the way through the Harry Potter series. I mean, they've read every single book. It's absolutely remarkable. And they sit there.
How old are they now?
9 and 10.
Ooh, it's a little intense.
Yeah, well, and, you know, they actually remember things about it, or their retention of it is quite good. What I've heard from teachers is their problem with Harry Potter, if there is a problem, would be that once children read those books, those are so engaging and so interesting that some of the books that are for their age levels are considered, you know, boring.
That's a problem?
Well, yeah, well, that's... Again,
move them on to Dickens. There's lots of good books that are complicated and well written.
Yeah, well, of course, teachers may not necessarily, you know, they have to teach certain books.
Do you listen to the audiobooks, the Jim Dale or the British versions?
I do not. No.
Oh, it's a good fun other thing to do with them with the books because the audio versions are really great.
Oh, really?
So we got a Oh, yeah. The Jim Dale audiobook. He reads the whole book and does like 100 voices, and they're tremendously good.
Oh, I have heard that actually.
If you've read the book. By all means, you can get the CDs at the library or download them or buy them or whatever. And, you know, for a road trip or when you're going to be in the car, it's great.
Ratings were huge for Saturday Night Live this past weekend, thanks to Donald Trump. The sketch show reached its biggest late-night audience in ages with about 9 million viewers, the most since January of 2012 when Charles Barkley and Kelly Clarkson appeared. Meanwhile, the show itself was panned, with everyone seeming to think NBC panicked a little over its decision. Trump was the host, but was seen so little after the monologue, you can be forgiven for forgetting that. In fact, one estimate by Variety was that he only appeared in 12 minutes of the show. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a 90-minute show.
Well, and what I will tell you is, that estimate is wrong.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I watched it on Hulu, so I'm not part of the 9 million, you know... Mm-hmm. He was in quite a bit of it, actually.
Oh.
More than I originally anticipated. I thought maybe he'll show up for news update, the weekend news. He wasn't.
How could they be wrong about that? Didn't they just time it?
I guess. He did the monologue. He was in a skit after that. He was in some music skit somewhere around. And he introduced Sia in one bit. He introduced her with like a 5-minute skit beforehand. So I don't know how they did their calculations, but I'd get the calculator on that one.
Nonetheless, pie on the face of NBC. Bad decision.
It was a bad decision. And frankly, I think it's a bad decision for Trump to be doing stuff like that. It's not very presidential, that's for sure.
That's where you think he went over the line?
Well, you know.
Insulting perhaps tens of millions of Americans might also be considered unpresidential. You're all rapists, you know.
And
I think that ship has sailed, Sperling.
All the top editors of a scholarly journal dedicated to linguistics have quit. Who cares, you ask? Better yet, who cares, I ask? Well, they objected to the journal Lingua, costing thousands of dollars a year for most libraries. Since many contributors did their work on a salary often paid for by taxes, why should the work be so expensive for other academics and the public to access? They're going to launch their own open access journal dubbed Glossa in 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. There's a real tipping point. Why not throw out a stupid phrase like that? Both for textbooks, which in a lot of basic categories shouldn't change much year to year. You know, math, high school math, grade school math, and the journal, the academic journals, which is a huge multi-billion dollar business. Don't get me wrong. But it's going to be upended because there's no reason why they should not be available free or very inexpensively to all the academic libraries and institutions around the country. And I think we're seeing people waking up and saying, no, 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 this has got to end. This archaic way of dealing with knowledge and stuff created by universities needs to be open source, needs to be in the public commons, and it's going to be faster than you can expect. And that's really going to hit the bottom line of some publishing giants.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this was true, and I can't remember the name of the database that. It's going to kill me. The internet, Aaron Schwartz actually is the person I was thinking of. He tried to make some database, some legal database.
Public. Yes. Yeah.
And basically it's all public information, but it's compiled into a database that then you have to pay for access to. And so he tried to say, look, he tried to free it by downloading it all and then putting it online. Obviously he, was taken to task for that and was put under such pressure that in the end he wound up committing suicide. But,
well, he was put under federal indictment.
Yes. So I do agree that when the public pays for things, they should have access to it. So I agree.
And the prices for it is ridiculous. There's such a small market for it. The idea that you would charge thousands of dollars just to access a journal on linguistics is kind of absurd on its face. But they got away with it because the people paying for it weren't actually paying for it. You know, they were just signing a check. It's like when your company gave you a subscription to Billboard Variety. They didn't care how expensive it was because, you know, your company paid for it, not you.
Right. The same thing with the Wall Street Journal. That's why it's so expensive.
Yeah, I mean, he did RSS. He did helped do Creative Commons and Reddit. I'm not sure which area of public knowledge he was trying to do.
It was the...
He was at MIT, and I know he was trying to link stuff up there.
It was the legal database, PACER, Public Access to Court Electronic Records. You have to pay for that. But it's public access.
Which now people are talking about digitizing and making available to everybody for free. It's just every court case ever done they want to do.
Right, precisely. Well, now this next story, I almost want to skip over because I know what you're going to say about it. Fox is building a theme park in Dubai. Among the attractions will be rides and worlds dedicated to Titanic, Aliens, Planet of the Apes, Sons of Anarchy, and human rights abuses. Oh, wait. Maybe not officially that last one, but outside organizations that do business in Dubai, like NYU, often find themselves tarnished by linking themselves to a country denounced by international human rights organizations. Similarly, Lionsgate is licensing its film properties for theme parks. See? They're not actually building the parks. They're just giving outside companies the opportunity to build rides for new parks based on their properties, such as the Step Up and Dance films, Divergent, and, of course, The Hunger Games. That would be such a great theme park. The Hunger... Wait, wasn't
They're it? Insisting they're going to do a theme park for Hunger Games.
Yeah, well, I say you just put the children in the park and you say, look, only one of you can come out. Everybody else, you have to kill. Two parks are on the drawing board and they're raising money. One for one for Atlanta and the other in China. But another park built around Hunger Games is moving forward at the UAE between Abu Dhabi, and Dubai. How will the locals ever wrap their head around a world where some live in lavish luxury while most suffer and slave away? Inquiring minds want to know. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop because nobody cares.
Yeah, nobody really cared about it.
Any protests? Any outrage? None.
Quentin Tarantino spoke at a political rally calling out the police... Quentin Tarantino spoke at a political rally calling out the police killing of certain victims as murder and the people who did it as murderers. He's faced a growing chorus of anger from police chiefs around the country, fanned by New York's tabloids. Chiefs from L.A. to New York to Chicago have all called for a boycott of Tarantino's movies. So has the Fraternal Order of Police, which has 330,000 law enforcement members. Tarantino has been defended by the likes of actor Jamie Foxx and remains defiant. Harvey Weinstein can't decide whether this is perfect grist for creating controversy and attention for the new Tarantino movie, The Hateful Eight, or a PR disaster. But they're officially standing by Tarantino, probably hoping it all goes away, rather than doubling down on this type of controversy. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, at the moment, it's a big whoop. One article, and I can't find it again, talked about some other boycotts that police unions have been calling for over the years, all of which were for movies that you'd never even heard of or did just fine. So they don't have actually a very good track record of boycotting movies. Like Tarantino and many others said, I wish they were more outraged about abuses by rogue bad cops than they were by the comments of a celebrity. You know, focus on that, not on what other people are saying. You know, what makes them angry is the snitch, the guy who tells on another cop, not the cop who's actually corrupt. And what's making them angry here is Quentin Tarantino saying something, you know, about crimes that have outraged the country, crimes or acts of violence that have outraged the country. He's not, you know, saying all cops are evil. He said, this is a horrible thing. It needs to stop. And it's just a shame that they are giving him so much attention rather than doing their job.
Well, yeah, you'd think that the police would have boycotted Straight Outta Compton, which has a song in it called F the Police. You know, instead, exactly. They did nothing about that. And, you know,
as someone said, cops are probably big fans of Tarantino's movies. You
exactly.
know, they love those movies. And frankly, I saw the trailer. It looks great.
Amazon has taken over a bricks and mortar store abandoned by Barnes and Noble and opened a full service bookstore. They've had outlets on college campuses, but this is their first full service bookstore, and it opens every day except Christmas and Thanksgiving. All books are displayed cover out, and most titles will be stocked only if they rank 4 stars or more on customer reviews. The prices? They're identical to the prices online, and since those change in the blink of an eye, no prices appear on them. You use an app or check at a price station or ask an employee the price for any book. So it's just like Barnes & Noble's. At the Amazon says it's the first but won't be their last brick-and-mortar store. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't figure out why they were doing this and what, and there's been about 10,000 articles written in, of course, the publishing industry. They're totally freaked out about it and paying attention and excited and scared. But the one thing that makes sense is that they're doing it for the data. They want, you know, when you use the app to check a price, they don't just see what books you buy, which they would know if you bought it online or bought it at the register with a credit card. They know what books you're browsing, what books you're even just taking the time to look at. So maybe you browsed at 7 or 8 books and checked the prices of them and you bought one, but they know every book that you picked up and checked the price on. And they think that maybe that data and seeing that customer activity is going to be really useful for them. And that's really what this is, a big tube, a test tube to try and see what happens. What are people doing? What are they looking at? What are they picking up? How can we use this information to sell them more stuff? And maybe apply this model to other retail environments, not just books.
Where is this store?
It's in, isn't it in California? Or Seattle. It's in Seattle.
Oh, that makes sense because they're in Seattle.
Yes,
and so that you know, lends that argument more weight because they can be
it's in their backyard.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right on that. I think 3 years from now, they will know without a doubt, hey, gee, Michael went into the bookstore and he showcased, as they call it. You know, he basically looked at all of these things, didn't buy anything, okay? But mm-hmm. he looked at 5 books. He looked up the price for 5 books. 2 weeks later, he bought one of those books. So they will be able literally to track how much.
And when you go online, they know that you, because you're logged into your Amazon account. So when you go online to check the price and then you do it three weeks later, they say, oh, he picked this book up already. Let's discount a little bit more to get him to buy it.
That's right.
So they're going to be doing variable pricing. I think they're going to do variable pricing for each customer. So it's going to be very annoying. You're in a store and you look at this book. For me, it's $8.95. And for you, it's $4.95. But like, hey, wait a second. But I'll tell you, what's really funny is they don't take cash.
Yes.
No cash. They want your credit card info, please. They want to know who you are, you were in the store, what you bought. No cash. Thank you very much.
And really, you know, Best Buy has one of the complaints about Best Buy, or the complaints Best Buy has, is that they have become a showcasing retail outlet, meaning that they, you know, people go in, they look at a product.
Like a big TV, a big screen TV. They want to see what it looks like, and then they buy it online for cheaper.
Exactly. And so Amazon is saying, okay, fine, come look at our products and buy them online. Who cares? You know, you're still going to be buying from us anyway.
That's right.
This last minute item here is a story about Activision Blizzard. And you know who that is, Michael?
They're a video game company, right? They do Call of Duty.
Now, get this. You know, this industry, video game industry, that is so big that the Santa Monica company, Activision Blizzard, is the third largest company in the space, and they have annual revenue of $4.9 billion. You might recall—
Just this one company.
Yeah, exactly. And you might recall $11 billion is the box office record for movies, and this one company is basically nearly 40% of that. So they've decided, they have a whole convention just for them called BlizzCon, and it happened in Anaheim, California over the weekend, and they announced that they are going to form a television and movie studio where they can turn their properties and all of the characters from their properties, like Call of Duty or like Skylanders, into movies and television shows. So would you consider that a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I don't know. Is it a bigger whoop that they bought Candy Crush for $6 billion? You know, they're big in first-person shooters.
That's right.
They're big in the multiplayer online world, like Warcraft, right? Isn't that them?
I believe so, yes. In fact, their movie Warcraft comes out next summer. Now, it's not their movie. You know, I think somebody else is releasing it,
right.
but it's their game.
Product.
Yeah.
Right. And so the one area they were weak in was mobile. And so they just said, all right, let's buy Candy Crush.
Yes.
So now they're a player in mobile. And now they're saying, do they just want toys to play with? Do they want to make movies because it looks like fun? Or is that really a great synergy for their video games? I guess we'll find out. Most video game movie things don't really work, do they?
No, and there have been more than a couple of companies that have tried to go from video games into movies, and it just hasn't worked out. There's the reasoning for this move, some see, as Bobby Kotick, who is the CEO of the company, some claim he wants to be a media mogul, and this is one way to do that.
That's not a reason, is it? I mean, that's...
Well, you know, stranger things have happened. I mean,
no. I'm saying, but that's not a reason. That's what he's doing.
He's becoming a media mogul, and he's always wanted to be
play in the movie and TV realm.
Right.
Maybe it's a case like Marvel, where they feel like, you know what, we're strong now. We know our product. We know what will work when we convert it to a movie. Because for a long time, Marvel was moribund, but when they got more control over their movies and were able to put some quality control and say, hey, we know what's going to work for our fans. Maybe they're saying, hey, we Call of Duty. My God, everybody knows that title.
Well,
right?
And it's funny that you bring up Marvel, because that was my thinking as well, is that when you look at a company like Marvel, they already had people making movies out of their properties. And they said, you know what? We should take control of this and become our own movie studio and participate with these studios in making those movies. And that's exactly what they did until such time as they were purchased by Disney. So for a while, they were doing it with Fox and with Sony, and now they're doing it with Disney as a part of Disney.
I guess the difference here is that there haven't been a lot of successful adaptations yet.
Correct.
Whereas Marvel did have a great Spider-Man series going on with Sam Raimi, but it hasn't happened yet for the Marvel video game.
Yeah, you know, another interesting thing here is that...
Candy Crush the movie.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Why?
Another interesting point to make here is that Twitch is this online streaming network where people will literally watch others play games. Sometimes live, sometimes recorded. And it's become, I mean, it was purchased by
Amazon.
I think for $1 billion is how much they paid for that. And so there is a market there. And the question then becomes, will there be user generated content where the users actually make the films and the television shows? I don't know. I mean, that's just one thought.
There aren't many films and TV shows made by users that are anything more than cult fun. I mean,
yeah.
I know people have recreated Star Trek, but, you know, and done their own little Star Wars. That's not really a business.
No, I don't think so. But we'll see.
All right.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Spren, before you get this, I have to turn off my holodeck. I left it on before we began the show. Let me just turn that off. Okay, I'm ready now.
You have a holodeck?
Sure.
Okay. Well, before the show, Michael and I got into an intense debate about...
I was very bitchy.
About virtual reality. Michael said, look, virtual reality, it doesn't even exist. It's not, quote, real, no pun intended, it's not real. Okay? It's going to be real. There's something happening that's...
I'm saying as a business and a thing that people do. I know that there's hundreds of millions of dollars invested in it, but I just didn't care. And it all started because the New York Times put some cardboard thing in our Sunday subscription. Suddenly there was this cardboard box with goggles in it. And my friend was like, here, what's this? I don't want it. You take it. And I'm like, I don't know what it is. And apparently you got to download an app to watch their virtual reality short film, but it's not even really virtual reality, is it? So what are we talking about? What did the New York Times do?
So what the New York Times did is they teamed up with Google to, as you say, distribute something called Cardboard. And you've
two crazy kids with a dream, New York Times and Google.
Yeah, exactly. Two multi-billion dollar crazy kids. Now, just maybe we should back up just a tad. You may have heard of Oculus, okay? Oculus is a virtual reality company. They make a headset that you put over your face, over your eyes. You can't see out of it other than, you know, what you're seeing projected at you through these goggles that don't have, you know, lenses. And that's a virtual reality headset. It comes with headphones, and between hearing and seeing, it feels real. The resolution is fantastic. Facebook purchased them for $2 billion a year or two ago, and they are kind of at the forefront of virtual reality, doing all of these experiments. The headsets are really priced for developers to play around with, and there are no publicly, they haven't marketed it yet to the public.
Right, it's not really commercial yet.
Yes.
It's still in the development stage.
So virtual reality is, that's where you basically block all reality out. You put something in front of your eyes so that you can't see what's actually in the real world, and your eyes and your...
Oh, it's not confusing. We understand.
Okay.
We got it.
Augmented reality is where you are looking at the real world, but have things and data and information and
like
images.
Like Google Glass.
Kind of like Google Glass, but on steroids. That's augmented reality.
But that's not in the real world yet either, right? I mean, people aren't walking down, right?
It is. Certainly some military applications use it.
Military, yeah. I mean, commercial, like people down the street.
No, it's actually much, much harder to pull off than virtual reality, because when people are walking down the street and they're looking into the distance, their iris and their eye is focused on far distance vision. And meanwhile, you're trying to project near distance objects into their eye. It's very, very difficult to pull off.
Sure. And virtual reality is you sit in a room with goggles on and you're in a controlled space, whereas augmented reality is you with your partial glasses or iris insert or whatever the hell it is, you're walking around in the world. So you got a lot more to deal with. That's a lot harder, obviously.
Right. Now, there are some companies like the Samsung Gear that allow people to download this stuff. And we're going to get to what the New York Times did. And you can put these your phone. You basically use it on your phone and you attach it to this headset. Not a whole lot of people have it, okay?
Right.
And now what the New York Times did...
It's at the toy stage right now, right? There's billions of dollars being spent on it. But as far as the general public is concerned, it's sort of a thing that's cool. And then you move on because it's not part of your life yet.
Yeah, the early adopters are beginning to adopt, okay? So those people who like...
Barely. Yeah,
like had an MP3 player before the iPod, okay? Those people are beginning to pick up on it.
Okay.
There are games that you can download if you have some of these, early versions of headsets and hardware. The phones, okay, like the one that the New York Times did or that Samsung did. So let's talk about what the New York Times did. They basically went out and they said the New York Times Magazine is going to make a couple of VR films.
Short films.
You can download them to your phone because we're going to provide a free app. We're going to deliver in our Sunday newspaper over 1 million Google Cardboards, which allow you to insert your phone into the cardboard. It basically looks like a cardboard version of a ViewMaster.
Yes.
Okay, that's what it, so it's got two little lenses in it, left eye, right eye.
It's like a little theater, and you peer through the goggles to see their augmented reality short film.
Not augmented. This is actually just...
Oh.
It's just a left eye, right eye, flat. It's not even in 3D, like virtual reality is. It is... What's the best
way? Why did we put it in this box, then?
Because you need the... Well, I guess maybe they're trying to make it 3D, but it the reason you put it in the box is when you do that, you actually are telling the story in 360. You can actually turn your head and the image turns. So for instance, in the Displaced, this is a story about three children who are refugees in the Ukraine, Sudan, and where's the third kid is in Lebanon from Syria. And basically, you can turn around. They're riding in a car. You can turn around. You can look at the mother. You can look at
rear window, left window, the back window.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's fascinating.
So why is this important? Is this like this? The Times embraces it means, okay, it's gone mainstream or it's going to go mainstream?
Well,
go mainstream?
Let's put it this way. When I first brought it up, you said, it's not real. Nobody's talking. Well, everybody's talking about it. Some better than others. Some are just kind of like jumping on the bandwagon. Here you have the New York Times. Okay. They're jumping on a trend. Fine. Okay, they're actually, and in a way, can you blame them? We all know print media is going the way of the dodo, so to speak, or at least everybody says that. So at least they're experimenting. Do they continue to experiment? Who knows? But they actually have turned this into another form of advertising. There was advertising on the cardboard, the little goggle thing. There was advertising in front of each of the little movies they have. Their one movie was an actual advertorial. Halfway through, I realized this is just an editorial ad for
GE. So the Times is monetizing their experiment. That's
yes.
Okay. But as far as I'm not supposed to call it augmented reality, what am I calling it?
It's in immersive video.
Okay. All right. So who else is jumping into this? I mean, because we know there's a lot of experimentation going on, but who's actually doing stuff creatively or commercially that the general public is going to consume?
Well, you probably could have downloaded Wild, which is a 3 or 4 minute thing that remember the movie Wild last year with Reese Witherspoon? Yeah. There was a thing where it was like 3 minutes long and it was her walking through the forest and she sits down right next to you and you can hear her whispering in your ear. And eventually you could turn around and look to the right and there is her mother, played by Laura Dern. And there's, you know, you can look down at your feet and you can look up at the sky and see the trees. And
but how did you do this? With what equipment?
Well, here's the thing, okay? This you can't go to any kind of trade conference, any type of film festival, any type of industry event without there being either an entire day devoted to VR or at least segments of the programming devoted to it. So last year at Sundance, they had this movie and it's a 20th Century Fox effort. There's a whole lab in 20th Century Fox that is devoted to kind of producing these experiences, so to speak, this content. And they allowed people to do it via the Oculus Rift. The resolution was spectacular. It felt like you were really there. And what's really now, but that said, you have to be connected. That headset is actually connected through a wire because the computing power that is required to make it look that real is enormous.
Sure.
Now,
so I'm sure they could do some interesting, cool, creative stuff with it. And they did interesting, cool, creative stuff with the CD-ROM and the Laserdisc. It doesn't mean that it will become an enduring form of art or an enduring business, but it sounds like there's lots of possibilities and it'll probably be a player down the road, right?
Well, yeah. And to give you some sense, so that was January of this year. October of this year, I went to the SMPTE conference and I walked into a room. There was the 20th Century Fox boys, right? And they said, oh, here, try the Samsung Gear headset. The same exact content. First of all, the resolution was horrible. You could see every single picture. It was like staring at a TV that's like an inch in front of your face. And so it was not a very good experience. And then after the 3 minutes, I took the headset off. And there's like, I'm standing there. There's got to be at least 500-600 people watching me. It was kind of a little unnerving. But they also, Ridley Scott directed a 17-minute version of The Martian in which you can kind of interact with Matt Damon.
Okay. Yeah, these are cool little demos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
They're demoing it. And that's really where it's at right now. And everybody's trying to figure out, as you said, Michael, where is it going to go?
Because and what's Magic Leap?
Magic Leap is augmented reality where you can literally put on the glasses and you could see... I think one of the things they showed was a whale jumping out of the gymnasium floor. It looked completely real. I mean, the demo I saw, if they can actually perfect this technology, it will be game-changing.
What's it for?
It's just for...
What is it? You put on the glasses and you just watch entertainment? Or is it for walking down the street and getting information like Google Glass? Or what is it?
I would say yes, because the answer is both. You can use it for entertainment purposes. You could use it for...
You're supposed to wear it all day long?
Well, I don't think they mean for you to be wearing it all day long, but in very specific instances, in very specific settings, and for specific purposes. Now, what the New York Times did, it basically made more people aware of VR, and therefore, you know, I think Wired called it VR's big mainstream moment, but it is coming. How it plays out, Michael, I agree with you. It's there's certainly some tracks you can kind of see how it's playing out. It's in the gaming world, okay, where there are obvious games. Sundance, for instance, they have a whole incubator.
First shooters are perfect for virtual reality, obviously.
Correct, but you can't walk around.
Because you're sitting on a couch in a room. You're not running around. You're sitting on a couch with a remote control in your hand. And so if you can immerse you in the environment of Call of Duty, sure, why not?
Precisely. The Sundance Story Labs, they're going to be kind of doing a little incubator for, you know, cinematic VR. Who knows where some of that goes.
Why would they need a story lab for, I mean, isn't that just a way of shooting it as opposed to?
Well, I think that they're trying to figure out a way to actually.
Choose your own adventures and crap like that.
Yeah. Now, some interesting things. There was, the New York Times stuff, in the displays. At one point, they're running after the girl from Syria, and if you turn around, you can see the boys chasing her. They gave one of them the camera to hold, and you can see him holding the camera on a stick. And much like, for instance, the CNN debate that was, you know, you could have, if you had the Samsung Gear, you could put on the Samsung Gear and watch it in 3D and in VR. And if you looked down at your feet, you were actually looking at the person who was sitting next to you and watching them write on their notepad. You were in the press section, and I thought, how funny. I wonder if that guy realizes we can see everything he's writing. So, you know, I think that the rules and the form that this takes has yet to be developed in full. If it ever gets developed in full, it may just evolve over time.
All right.
But I know, Michael, you're already calling it the new 3D in your mind.
No, because 3D is just sort of a whiz-bang addition to movies, and it doesn't really, this is an entirely different category. Whether it works or not, I don't know, but I can certainly see people wanting to put on an immersive headset to play a first-person shooter. Makes perfect sense to me.
Well, do you think they will actually want to put on a headset to watch any content from Australia? Because that is where some of our listener emails come from this week.
All right, why don't you read the first one or condense it a little bit, and I'll read the second.
Okay, well, James Gardner from Australia, he writes in frequently.
And he's responding because we talked about how the Australian box office was at a peak year as far as the percentage of the whole country's box office. Australian-made films were having one of their banner years, if not their record-setting year of all time.
Right, at 6%, I might add.
Yes.
Dirt at Showbiz Sandbox is how James got to us. D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. He says, hello, Sperling and Michael. I wanted to comment on the recent Australian film industry turnaround. The fact that Australian films, as a percentage of box office, has turned around from one of the worst years on record to this year being a record year does beg the question, what has changed? In my opinion, this turnaround in Australian cinema is connected to recent changes in the Australian production industry landscape. This has changed the dynamics of how films are made in Australia. And effectively what he's saying is a large post-production company went out of business due to a legal dispute, and that particular company held sway over a large part of the industry and was a big gatekeeper. And without that gatekeeper there, more Australian films can get distribution and theatrical distribution based on their artistic integrity rather than on relationships and a who-you-know thing. He goes on to say, the fragmentation of the industry has removed this limitation, letting the art of cinema float back to the top. This has led to a renaissance in Australian cinema. The big lesson to take from this, artistic integrity is of huge importance to the success of your film. And that comes from James Gardner in Australia.
That's right. We've got an email from Andrew, who I assume is also from Australia. I don't know.
Andrew Einsbrook.
We know who it is. Oh, yeah, okay. Wild, this is Andrew here.
Yeah, Wild Pure Heart Productions.
All right. Well, he says, the whole domestic box office thing is fascinating to me, as are issues around government support. So many Aussie films disappear without a trace as they fail to make a dent in the movie-going consciousness. The country makes 2 or 3 dozen features a year that get a cinema release, and he has a link in the notes. Many are low budget at $1.5 million Australian dollars and under, and yet one's little indie flick still has to get attention away from every other English language film on the planet and non-English language ones as well. Successful Aussie films and Aussie theaters are the exception, not the rule. The French go see French films. About 70% of French domestic gross are French movies. The Brits see British films. Americans, of course, see American films. But Australian producers really struggle to get Aussies to see their films. Some films just aren't any good, but even decent films have a hard time attracting box office. That is why government screen production support usually has a strong cultural mandate to justify it rather than, say, a business mandate. If there wasn't government support, in the case of TV rules that set some quotas for domestic production being broadcast, the sector would shrivel. And yet, as you noted on the show, the talent making Australian films and TV is world-class and punches well above its weight. Plus, research shows that Australians do like to see Australian shows and hear Australian voices depicted in their screen culture, especially on TV. But clearly, with 6%+ being a banner year at the box office, it's a tough row to hoe. Plus, as models of distribution change, it is becoming harder and harder for distributors to justify the risk and expense of a theatrical release. More and more, they'll look to non-theatrical options as the most viable for product they've acquired. There's no easy solution or answer. I guess Australian producers just need to keep doing the work, making good product, and do what they can to spark interest, just like every other producer on Earth. Keep up the great work. I continue to listen to every podcast. Cheers, Andrew.
Well, does this mean that we're going to have to speak with an Australian accent?
No, thank God we didn't even try to do that.
Okay, so
it was tempting.
It was, yes. But we appreciate all of our listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And when you call and leave us a voicemail, we appreciate that too. You can call 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher, and soon Google, actually the Google Play Store.
And soon in virtual reality.
Yes. Actually, my question is, do we need to be, you know, do we need to create our own 360 degree content?
We don't even shoot video yet.
Yeah, that's probably true. Let's at least do that. Or maybe just a picture of us would be nice.
Boy.
So again, you can subscribe to the show. It does help us out when you do that. You can email us, call us. You can follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. On Facebook, you just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and our page is there. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all the links to stories that we've discussed in today's episode. Again, the website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I'm virtually bored by reality.com.
That's actually a great website name. I'm going to go reserve that right now if it's not already reserved. But, you know, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's work and coverage of the entertainment industry there, head on over to michaelgiltz.com. The Huffington Post has some of his work. Of course, bookfilter.com. You can always find Michael's work there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week. Actually, not until next week.
What?
Yes, I forgot to mention.
Oh my God, you should have said it at the top of the show.
I know, I forgot.
You little bastard.
I forgot. Hopefully,
what's happening next week?
I am going to Brazil.
But then there's Thanksgiving the week after that, or 2 weeks after that? Good Lord. Oh, you're going to Brazil? Oh, okay, good. Well, that's for business, so
yes,
hopefully that's
business.
Working out well.
It's Expo Cine takes place next week, and so I will be in Brazil for that. After that is Thanksgiving.
Because they don't have Wi-Fi in Brazil. You can't possibly do the show while you're there.
Well, I'll be working. Plus, I'll be upside down. Isn't that on the other side of the planet?
And if we're not paid, it's not work, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Feel free to pay us. I don't even know when the next show will be.
Well, it's 3 weeks away for Thanksgiving. Well, no, it's not. 18/25. So that could be a rough week, but we will want to catch up. We'll have to see if we can do it. It's all on Sperling's shoulders.
Well, we'll try to get you a new show as soon as possible. But until then, play nice.